The Murthy Law Firm has been clarifying U.S. immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. I am Sheila Murthy, President and CEO at the Murthy Law Firm. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion about priority date issues in the visa bulletin. Joining me for today's teleconference are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Jessica Beaver, who is along with Jim McLaughlin, both coordinators in the perm/green card department, knowledgeable, brilliant, caring, compassionate attorneys, whom I'm proud to call my esteemed colleagues. So today we're going to talk a little bit, as I said earlier, about the visa bulletin, its impact, how it works, and answer some questions, make it short and sweet so that you can understand the context. So what's the visa bulletin? Well, as we all know, the U.S. Department of State each month releases the visa bulletin. And the visa bulletin provides the movement of the priority dates for employment-based and family-based cases. We say employment because Murthy Law Firm, we tend to do a lot of employment-based cases, but we also do a lot of family-based cases. But actually, in reality, the number of people coming in through the family option under U.S. immigration law is way larger. So actually, in the Department of State bulletin, if you look at it each month, it'll show the family-based first and then the employment-based. And in that, you have a bunch of other issues that are described in detail. And we're going to get to what it actually means, but basically that's when you're eligible to file something. And I'm going to invite maybe Jessica to jump in and join to explain, you know, what is the difference between dates of filing and final action date, or jump to Jessica to talk a little bit about, you know, what the employees need to have ready to move forward to become eligible to file. So at this point, I am going to invite Jessica Beaver to speak a little bit about the difference between the dates of filing, the final action date, and what that means. Jessica, take it away.
Sure. So as many people know, as of October 2015, the Department of State has put out two visa bulletins. As Sheila mentioned, one's the final action and one is the dates for filing. So the Department of State may put out the visa bulletin each month, but ultimately the USCIS is going to tell you which chart to use. So when in doubt, you can use the final action chart. Only when you're given permission can you use dates for filing. And the advantage of dates for filing is that you can get your case in the queue. Unfortunately, it cannot be approved unless it's current on the final action chart, but you can get those benefits of employment authorization and advanced parole, as well as, you know, protect some of your children who may be aging out. So keep in mind that these two visa bulletins are out and only the USCIS can indicate which one we can use each month.
Thank you, Jessica. Okay, moving right along, there's a whole bunch of documents that one needs to be able to submit along with the I-485 Adjustment of Status application, in order to ensure that it is accepted and by the USCIS and can be processed. So Jim, why don't you speak a little bit about the sorts of documents like the birth documents, marriage documents, those kinds of documents, which sometimes in some countries like India and many parts of the world could take years or months, if not several, not just weeks, but maybe several months to obtain. So, Would you like to go over that?
Yeah, absolutely. So employers that are helping their employees to get to, when they get to this stage of the process for the adjustment of status, or if they happen to be going through immigrant processing, a common question is, okay, what documents do we need? The hardest documents, like you mentioned, often to gather are birth documentation and marriage docs, just depending on the culture and processes of the native country where they were born and where they were married. So one of the first things all of these need is birth documentation. The birth documentation needs to be, they need to have the original, ideally if there's an interview, but they'll only submit the copy to either USCIS or the Department of State. And you want to verify the visa reciprocity schedule for what the birth documentation is, what is accepting, because different offices will have different obligations and restrictions. But one of the things that are common for USCIS to accept the birth certificate itself would be that it was registered when you're at the birth, list the full name of the child, and list the full name of the parents. In some countries, some of that information will be lacking, so you may need secondary documentation as well. When you don't have the certificate that meets that requirement, the secondary documentation generally is going to be affidavits. You need at least two of them. And say you were born in India, a common secondary document would be school leaving certificate or other documents such as a government document. The older the document, the more valuable it is for the process. For marriage documentation, same sort of process. You'll want to check the visa reciprocity schedule, make sure you have the correct registered marriage certificate. If that's not available, then you'll have to look at secondary documentations and possibly affidavits as well.
Great. Thank you so much, Jim. Moving right along, so besides the birth and marriage documents, obviously the person needs to establish that each person who's filing the adjustment of status or 485 with all related documents needs to show that they have been maintaining either valid non-immigrant status or they're at least in a period of authorized stay. But let's first focus on valid non-immigrant status. So what's valid non-immigrant? Right from the first day you enter the U.S. till you're filing the 485, right? So if you came in on a student visa, you need your I-20, you need proof of your F-1 status, your I-94 cards. When you each time you enter the country, you can pull it from the cbp.gov website. Each time you travel and re-enter, you want to double check because a lot of people end up making innocent mistakes that can be very stressful and result in serious consequences. For example, if your passport is expiring before earlier and your I-94 is shortened or truncated for different reasons, but you want to keep copies of your F-1 approval, your H-1, L-1, whatever your non-immigrant status is, all proof of your I-20s, your H-1 petition approval notices. If you had an EAD card, proof of the EAD card, you need to make a copy of all the non-blank pages from each of your passports, from all prior passports until the current passport. Maybe you need to attach a copy. You should attach a copy of the visa from your most recent entry, as I said, the I-94 card. So all of that, along with all these birth, marriage, and other documents, establishes your eligibility for adjusting from non-immigrant to immigrant status within the United States. So the next issue that we'll briefly touch upon is something that we unofficially call downgrade. People say, oh, I want to upgrade my petition or downgrade my petition. Well, there's nothing like upgrade or downgrade in the law, but we use that because when people from EB2 go to EB3, the employment-based second preference to third preference, we refer to it as downgrade. Of course, it became very, very popular, as we all know, in October, November of 2020, when the dates moved dramatically and EB3 was slightly ahead of EB2. So why is it helpful? What does it mean? What is the purpose of doing that? So let me invite you, Jessica, to talk a little bit about that.
Sure, Sheila. And like Sheila mentioned, it's really beneficial. So that way people can have both an EB2 and an EB3 I-140. And so basically the process to file one of these so-called downgrade petitions is essentially refiling an I-140. And we recommend not to mark it as an amendment. It's a separate petition. This way you get that benefit of having both an EB2 and an EB3 approval in case the dates move back and forth. Typically, you can't file it in premium processing because the labor certification is in a different file and has likely expired. You can try to upgrade it once you get the receipt notice. We have seen that USCIS may say, hey, wait 30 days, to upgrade. Eventually, you'll be able to upgrade to premium processing if you wish. Some of the common issues that we've seen in the past with filing these so-called downgrade I-140s is for these really old petitions, what may have once worked for education and experience may not work now. So it's important to take a look at that, prior to deciding to file again. Similarly, showing the ability to pay from the time the labor certification is filed and going forward. So this can be difficult for these old priority dates where you're trying to show ability to pay from 2013, 2014 time period, especially especially if an employee has left and rejoined. That could be a potential issue where the employer needs to show the full offered wage in their tax returns because they don't have the ability to show the employee's W-2s for ability to pay. Additionally, employers can always get an ability to pay RFE for all of their sponsored I-140 petitions. So this sometimes, can cause an issue. So very important to sort of vet the I-140 again for these issues, looking at education, experience, and ability to pay prior to deciding to file this quote-unquote downgrade petition.
Thank you, Jessica. You know, I think we just can't emphasize enough because people get excited to see their friends, their neighbors, their colleagues, whatever. Oh, I did this, and now I'm able to file the I-140. And a lot of lawyers during the October-November 2020 timeframe ended up marking it as an amendment, thinking they were somehow helping the individual and family members. But in reality, then when, again, EB-2 moved forward, it created major complications if you mark it as an amendment, because that means you amended that I-140 to the EB-3, and now you again have to refile. Whereas if you just do it as a separate one, the way at Murthy Law Firm we did it, then you have both options, like Jessica just said, right? And be very, very careful, be careful what you wish for, as they say in life, because a lot of the people who tried to do it then had issues, as Jessica correctly pointed out, with financial ability to pay, all of those issues we raised, education and work experience, et cetera, and ended up then losing both EB-3 and EB-2. So it's important to be very careful. Next, let's talk about, what are the other kinds of options that most of our clients tend to just have at the back of their mind. Jim, maybe I'll have you jump in.
Sure. I think a little background might be important to answer this. So most professionals go through the PERM labor certification process, but depending on the country you were born in, means you may be waiting a really long time for your priority to become current, eventually be able to adjust status, get your green card, get your immigrant visa. So one of the common questions we get from employers, is there anything else we can do for our employee? He's been sitting here waiting forever. He's been promoted through his career. He started off as a programmer, and now he's a manager. He's a VP, whatever it may be. So often they're thinking about, is there anything else we can do to help this person? They're still waiting a really long time. And the most common option really is the multinational executive manager or executive. This is something where you don't, already have to be in the PERM process, but the difference is it's EB-1. So with PERM, you get either EB-2 or EB-3. So you're born in India, you may be waiting a decade or two before you'd be able to file your adjustment of status. So another option may be to consider, okay, has this employee been promoted through the position that perhaps we could transfer them abroad? They could work in that upper-level managerial executive position, then perhaps come back, and we could file an EB-1 petition for them. So the key with the multinational executive manager position is that the person has to be working outside the U.S. for at least one full year for an affiliate of the organization, subsidiary, parent company, something to that effect, in that upper-level managerial or executive position. The key is you don't want it to be a first-line supervisor. You're talking about something beyond that. Perhaps they have some reports to them. They've got some budgeting responsibilities. Have them in that outside for that organization, that subsidiary. Have them transferring back to the U.S. to continue that upper-level manager or executive position. So that's the most common option. You also have other options such as outstanding researcher or professor. So if you are a business that does research, that certainly might be an option for your professor if you're university or college. There might even be an exceptional ability option, but that's really the person self-petitioning, not so much geared towards you as the employer. But keep in mind, for those, it's really the strictest scrutiny where an individual really has to be well-known, publishing as being really the top part of their career. One of the other options, and once again, it may not be great for the employer as an employer-based position, but if you have somebody that perhaps you want to assist, another option is EB-5. For that, the individual is essentially investing significant amounts of money, depending on the situation, whether it's their own business, you're going to have a higher level of investment, or if it's a target employment area, something to that effect, it would be, you know, significantly less, but you're still talking about upwards of, you know, perhaps $900,000 to $1.8 million for the business.
Thank you, Jim. And I know we didn't touch upon EB-4, but again, most people that we are, who are clients of mostly law firm, probably don't do EB-4, but it's special immigrants, religious workers, you know, people under Patriot Act. There's a very comparatively smaller percentage, but again, that's why you do your research, you check it out, you speak to a knowledgeable immigration attorney, make sure you're leaving no stone unturned to look at, consider all of your options. So another question that we often get asked, of course, is what if my employee already has filed a 485 with a prior employer or has a pending 485 from before? You know, can they continue with it? Can they take advantage of it? So generally, we actually recommend, based on what USCIS headquarters and National the Service Center Operations has told us repeatedly, it is safest and best to avoid filing, you know, a new 485, even though some lawyers tend to kind of go with that option. Now, of course, if you're changing employers and you haven't filed a 485, then you would have to start with a fresh perm and an I-140. But if you are continuing in the same or similar job duties, you could use the old perm, the I-140, as long as the 485 has been filed and pending for a minimum 180 days, which is a little like approximately 6 months, but not exactly. It's just a few days this way, that way. And you, again, need to make sure that you're eligible to take advantage of the AC-21 adjustment of status portability provisions under the American Competitiveness in the 21st Century Act, or AC-21 as we refer to it. So again, in most cases, you won't need to file a perm or I-140 if you have the approved I-140. And then there's a whole thing about approvable when filed issue, which we've done some cases, but honestly, it's so much safer to wait for the I-140 approval for your employee, or if you're the employee, to wait for it prior to deciding to move. As I said, the 485 pending 180 days, same or similar job classification as mentioned in the original labor certification and I-140 petition. And of course, the new employer needs to file the supplement J, the 485 supplement J, to confirm the nature of the job duties and to confirm that it is in fact either same or very similar, that we can then hopefully continue with the previously filed and approved I-140, the permanent I-140 petition. And finally, before we try to wrap up, the question is, what if my employee wants to transfer the basis of the pending 485 to a better or a different category, right? So how does that work, Jessica?
So transferring the basis is what people used to also refer to as interfiling. They're sort of, you know, synonymous. So only when the priority date is current on final action can you request to transfer the basis. So typically when you're going from, let's say, EB-2 to EB-3 or EB-3 to EB-2, you'd still file another I-485 Supplement J. This form is used, like Sheila mentioned, for AC-21 notifications, but it's also used to confirm the job offer in an initial filing, but also when you're transferring the basis. It's really important when your employees look at these options because it could affect aging out children. They really have to think about Child Status Protection Act issues if they want to transfer between categories, because that could affect their child from aging out. They also can transfer between employment-based categories to family-based categories, or from family-based to employment-based. On the USCIS website, they do give dedicated directions where to send the Supplement J if it's an employment-based, or where to send this written request if they're transferring to another category. It is possible to, you know, be able to transfer the category back and forth, but you would have to do a fresh Supplement J filing each time. So it is true that if the visa bulletin were to move back and forth between EB-2 and EB-3, it is possible to make that notification to the government. But like I said, it's only when the priority date is current on final action that you can request to transfer that basis.
And what about in the with employment-based and family-based categories? I know at one point USCIS said it wasn't allowed, but it seems like they're allowing it nowadays. to use the same 485, both for employment and family base, if that moves is moving faster for you.
Right, and that can be a little bit tricky when you don't have that Supplement J that has a receipt number and you've sent a letter into the government. So sometimes that's when it's necessary to get the congressperson involved, to get their immigration liaison following up with USCIS to match those files up. So it definitely is possible, and as you mentioned, the USCIS prefers you not to file multiple I-45 applications, but it does become a little bit more tricky when you've made written notification where you may have delivery confirmation, but unfortunately not a receipt notice with a receipt number. So we do sort of have to follow up on those case types when those happen as well. But it is possible.
Yeah. And just sort of chime in, you know, as a strategy, that's why it's important to talk to your attorney, because it may be that having 245s is for you specifically in your circumstance a better idea than the interfiling. But that's something to discuss with your attorney to determine if it really is.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jessica. And as you can see, we're trying to make this short and sweet of discussion of hitting the main highlights, so that whether you're the employer doing it for your employees or the employee looking at your paperwork and trying to figure out things, it's very important to understand the lay of the land, how the immigration system works. So there's physical life, and then there's your immigration life, which is just as precious and valuable. And so important for you to understand a lot of these issues. Make sure you get the right people on your team to guide you, mentor you, assist you, and walk you through this process. Again, we've touched, to just summarize and wrap up, we have touched upon the priority date movement, options that are available, EB2, EB3, dates of filing, final action date, the downgrade, the upgrade, the ability to pay, transferring the basis of the underlying petition, all of that. And then there's, of course, the entire Child Status Protection Act, protecting if your children are teenagers and going to miss it. And I know Jessica and Jim, we all just briefly touched upon it. But the goal is to highlight issues for you to understand what's going on. If you don't have a fantastic immigration legal team supporting you, certainly feel free to contact us at the Mufti Law Firm. Feel free to take advantage of the free Mufti Bulletin, the forum, the chat, the whole bunch of free services that we offer. And again, our goal is education and empowerment of employers, employees, and families going through the process. On behalf of Jessica Beaver, Jim McLaughlin, myself, Sheila Mufti, and the entire Mufti Law Firm team, we want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to continuing to take excellent care of you, your employees, and anybody, family or friends, with respect to any immigration law matters. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to continuing to take excellent care of you all. Have a great rest of the day. Thanks.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Mufti Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.